wish I was a mole in the ground.
First Nations and our people that been living here for thousands of years.
Stand up.
We've been fighting for our freedom since the Nina and the Pinta and the Santa Maria.
Stand up.
Like Geronimo, Sitting Bull, Red Cloud, Crazy Horse, Leonard Peltier.
Stand up.
Now they poisoning the waters for our sons and our daughters, so we on the frontier.
We won.
One nation, one cause, one people, one tribe. Now it's us against the pipeline.
This is Lakota Cheyenne Mole Robin White coming to you on Indigenous Peoples Day and bringing you a show focused on Indigenous voices and Indigenous issues. I hope that everybody takes time today to really listen to some of what's being said and try in your mind and your hearts to really work on making solutions to some of these situations. It's been 500 years. I think that's long enough. Humans are powerful people. They can do things to make some of these things right. Let's honor the treaties. Let's bring the people who are at the bottom up. When you bring the lowest boat up, you bring everybody up. This morning lineup includes my conversation with Nimapu Nez Perce Mole member Julian Ankeny. They speak about murdered and missing Indigenous peoples, and Julian reads a poem by C. Marie Furman that links land acknowledgments and MMIPs. Then John Hacken speaks with Don Sampson, Pio Pio Mox Mox chief of Walla Walla peoples, former chairman and chief executive director at the Confederated Tribes of the Umatilla Indian Reservation, and current climate change project director for the Affiliated Tribes of Northwest Indians. Sampson reflects on the role of Native storytelling in responding to the climate crisis and in educating on climate issues. The program pays special tribute to beloved departed Umatilla storyteller Esther Motanik with a reading of The Monster Who Came Up the River and discussion of her life and work. And finally, Bill Resnick speaks with Oglala Lakota tribal member Henry Redcloud, who is enrolled at Pine Ridge and is the founder of Lakota Solar Enterprise, a small business, and Redcloud Renewable, an educational nonprofit, creating an overall project that has thrived pursuing a mission of preserving and enhancing Lakota traditional culture in a modern world. Henry Redcloud discusses how respect for nature and cooperative work in which all workers can be seen as essential and rewarded as such, furnishes the values foundation for the reconstruction necessary to retain a livable planet. Today, I'm interviewing Julian Ankeny. Julian Ankeny is a Nimapu Nez Perce residing on the Nez Perce Reservation in Lapwai, Idaho. She teaches Native literature, creative writing, fiction, nonfiction, and English 101 at Washington State University, Vancouver, and Pullman. Ankeny is currently the assistant fiction editor for Blood Orange Review and has joined the Visiting Writers Series at Washington State University. She also teaches a class for the Education Department each summer that focuses on language, reclamation, revitalization, and the importance of Nez Perce language and culture. Among Ankeny's talents, she is a commentator and interviewer for the Old Mole and is the 2020 recipient of the Associate Faculty of Women Founders Award at Washington State University. Her work is published in Talking River, the Yellow Medicine Review, and she was featured in the Berkeley Hearst Museum's online exhibit, Cloth That Stretches, Weaving Community Across Time and Space, which explores textiles as a site of identity formation and cultural resilience. Lastly, Ankeny is a founding member of the Nimapu Lhkapslemi Writers Collective. Ankeny's brother went missing in 2018, and the case remains open. Hey, Julian, welcome to the show.
Tiao, Robin. Thank you for having me.
So on this kind of auspicious Indigenous Peoples Day, where we're trying to get rid of the colonial past and the celebration of genocide of Native peoples, what are you thinking about today on Indigenous Peoples Day? What's on your foremost on your mind?
Well, first and foremost, I would like to acknowledge that Indigenous people stand in solidarity with our ancestors. and that our story is a story of continued genocide through blood quantum and certificates of Indian blood, a very colonial practice. We were the first stewards of this land and believe we are a part of this land, and those things cannot be disconnected. I kind of wanted to go over the epidemic of missing and murdered Indigenous people because my brother, Michael Murphy, has been missing since 2018. The epidemic of missing and murdered Indigenous people has been an almost invisible crisis for far too long until recently. One study done by the Urban Indian Health Institute found that 5,712 cases of missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls were reported since 2016. That 96% of violence against Indigenous peoples are from non-natives, and out of the 5K plus people missing, only 116 of those cases as a whole were logged in the Department of Justice database. The facts are that Native people are 10 times more likely to experience violence as well as lateral violence than any other ethnicity.
I have to bring up here that I think that in most cases we did get some reprieve from this, but that as a temporary thing, that we have no ability to prosecute non-Indians on the reservation. So these crimes largely go unpunished. You have talked about the relationship of murdered and missing Indigenous peoples and its land acknowledgement. Can you go into that a little deeper?
Yes, I will. Thank you. So not only is this a problem of land and people, this is a problem that cuts across ages and genders. Now the appropriate acronym would be MMIP, or Missing and Murdered Indigenous People, as an inclusive initiative to bring awareness to the fact that while most of the attention and research is on the violence against Indigenous women and girls, our men and boys are vulnerable too. Indigenous men, as well as Two-Spirit people and their disappearances, murders, need to be addressed as well, as the patterns of violent victimization against men and boys are also placed in the context of gender and settler colonial violence as a whole. Every person we search for, march for, grieve for is another person that law enforcement disregards, devalues, dehumanizes, and cases were never brought to light. Human beings, Ntitlwit, are sacred beings that every border town, city, ignored, abused, abducted, and trafficked Indigenous people has been grossly ignored. These people become the stories that news media refuses to tell, the cases that legal systems do not prosecute, and that white feminists write up resolutions that will travel no place. The facts that are man camps and oil and land acknowledgments are all interconnected. I would like to read a poem to acknowledge that the land itself, along with the people whose language, culture, and religion were born of it, is rarely acknowledged, by one of my good friends and sisters, C. Marie Furman. Let us pause for a moment and acknowledge the land on which we lived, the traditional lands of Indigenous people. We should take another moment to acknowledge the ways Indigenous people have been and are being removed and erased from the land they've stewarded for over 16,000 years, swiftly, brutally, culturally, fatally. Let us acknowledge that soldiers of the United States killed women and children because they were Native. Let us acknowledge the recentness of this. Let us acknowledge that Native people buried in their land without markers, while unnamed settlers rest in fenced graves. Let us acknowledge Indian graves dug up and looted. Let us acknowledge that place names like Squaw Meadows and dead Indian do not honor ancestors. Let us take a moment and acknowledge that this land was not stolen from the people whose language, culture, and religion were born of it. Let us acknowledge that the people were stolen from this land. The people who celebrate this land with song, dance, ceremony, people who do not commodify and commercialize trees and water or call it resource. Here we pause to acknowledge that the land itself is rarely acknowledged. The land buried beneath asphalt, cement, floorboards, and foundations. Let us acknowledge that this buried land, which once grew food and medicine, now grows dollar stores and subdivisions. Let us acknowledge the land in the way subdividers do, with the blade of a bulldozer and with names like Forest Trails, Aspen Ridge, River Ranch, with words the way the government recognizes only federally recognized tribes and has taught some natives to recognize other natives only on paper, through blood quantum and certificates of Indian blood, instead of commitment to rights and sovereignty. Let us recognize land acknowledgments that serve as consolation. Another box checked on a list titled Due Diligence. The way wearing a Black Lives Matter t-shirt acknowledges white wokeness while the same whites shop at whites' lives businesses. Acknowledgement as performative allyship. Let us acknowledge that internment camps were prisons. This land acknowledgement was written for the people who acknowledge land in the way spotted knapweed acknowledges it, the way for sale sign acknowledges it, the way the Forest Service acknowledges land by stating hashtag it's all yours, but meaning hashtag it's not theirs. This statement acknowledges the land in the same way the media and FBI acknowledge over 5,000 missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls, by recognizing the one missing white woman for whom hundreds search and whose picture is present on all of our screens, the way Native silhouettes are screened on paper to sell cigarettes. This land acknowledgement is inked on the heartwood of a pine that escaped the fires but fell for the mill from the land that cannot help but acknowledge climate crisis and carrying capacities. The grizzly bear fatally removed and the salmon who can no longer reach their original homelands. This land acknowledges the wolves shot by stockmen and sportsmen to preserve the animals stockmen and sportsmen will thenceforth kill in the name of husbandry and sport. Let us acknowledge how we honor loss with dollars and not grief. Let us make depredation a science and pay officers from the Bank of Conservation. Let us acknowledge the words used to dissociate, kill, killing, killer, killed, from the act of execution. This land acknowledges that it is recognized for its monetary value, recreational value, and aesthetic value, because it too is living. This land recognizes us by our carbon footprint, our clear cuts, our gold mines, and our greed. This acknowledges that land back means language back, means medicine back, means ceremony back, means culture back, means reparations, means all people depend on the land. Let us acknowledge that unless action is taken to identify and empower Indigenous people, erase inaccurate histories from every curriculum, and carry out land-based justice and climate change policy, a land acknowledgement is a perfunctory, alienating, and otherwise hollow gesture. Acknowledgement means acceptance, admittance. Acknowledgement is a dead word, is not a verb, is not dead, does mean education. Acknowledgement means too late for an apology. Read me your declaration of change. Detail your plan of procedure. Show me your map to equality. And then, just maybe then, I might be convinced that your land acknowledgement is not just another broken treaty. Yoch Kalo. Thank you. That is all.
Thank you, Julian. I really appreciate you being here today. I hope you come back soon. We'll do some more. Have a good day.
Thank you, Robin. Katsiaoyao.
So I think if you listen, truly listen to everything that was said there, I think you can search within your heart and your spirit and find some things that may be available to you to remedy some of these situations. You know, let's start doing the right thing. Thanks. This is Robin White, KBOO Radio, Portland, Oregon.
My people, my land. My people, my land. This is the way the life was given. The way we were made to stand. My people, my land. My people, my land. Honor all creation.
Just been listening to Perfect, My People, My Land. This is Robin White, the Old Mole Radio Hour, KBOO, Portland, Oregon. Next up, Jan Hawkins speaks with Don Sampson, Kau Piau Mox Mox Chief of Walla Walla Peoples. This piece starts with Don Sampson telling the story of the monster who came up the river.
The monster who came up the river. This huge monster came up from the ocean. He would open his huge mouth and inhale anything that was in his path. He soon had all the salmon and other fish like sturgeon and eels all eaten, and because he was so huge, he began taking in the deer and all food animals of the forest. Soon there was nothing left for the people, and they were getting hungry. And babies and old people began to die. Finally, someone went to Coyote and told him he would have to kill the monster. He got a length of a vine that is called Coyote's rope. He tied one end around his waist and coiled the other around his arm. He got some pitchy kindling and flints for starting a fire. He stood on a far hill and called the monster a shameful name. He teased him until the monster began trying to eat him. Every time the mouth opened, Coyote would throw out some useful thing. The monster was near collapsing. The fire got so hot that the monster died and went back into the sea. Some parts of him clung to the sides of the riverbank, so it was rough like it was before Bonneville Dam was built. Thank you.
That was Don Sampson, Pio Pio Max Max, chief of the Walla Walla tribe, narrating The Monster Who Came Up the River, written by beloved Umatilla storyteller Esther Motanik. Don Sampson is director of the Affiliated Tribes of Northwest Indians Climate Change Project and has been a leader for decades in tribal government and non-tribal agencies. My name is Jan Hawken, and I'm a documentary filmmaker from Portland and a programmer at KBOO Community Radio. Well, it's an honor to be with you today on KCUW, Don, to talk about this fable written by Esther Motanik and to discuss the place of Native storytelling in the climate justice movement.
Thanks, Janice. Great to be here with you today.
Well, let's start by talking about Esther Motanik, who wrote this story. Can you tell us some about her?
Yeah, actually, Esther was quite well known here. She was quite a soprano singer. She was, of course, went to college and was one of the first young women, Native women, that became one of the queen of the Pendleton Roundup. Her father was a well-known leader and businessman here, Parson Motanik. He was a member of Cayuse tribe, and he was the second Native American on the Umatilla Indian Reservation to purchase an automobile.
That was quite something. What decades are we talking about here?
Yeah, well, this is back in 1915 when he had his first automobile. There's a famous picture of him. You know, he was he's posed in a traditional headdress. He was a farmer, rancher, had horses and cattle. His children here, of course, which included Esther, and she was one of the first Native American women to be named to the Queen of the Pendleton Roundup. His son, Art, Esther's brother, was active in the Roundup for 70 years and was also a well-known singer during the Happy Canyon Pageant. He was there. Don was there at my father's chief ceremony and sang. And so very talented, educated family here on the Umatilla Indian Reservation, but also carried on a lot of the traditional knowledge, including the storytelling, the legends, the history of our tribe. And she and my grandmother grew up together, Carrie Sampson, and my father, Carl Sampson, the late Carl Sampson, who was the former chief, also named Pio Pio Mox Mox. And so very close connection to our family. Her son, one of the sons, Don Motanik, the grandchildren, he's a forester and works on many issues across the U.S. with tribes on forest management. So very respected family. And, you know, Esther was one of those very energetic but also very powerful, progressive woman in her age.
Women have also been storytellers in many Native cultures. Can you say a little about that?
Yeah, that's what I learned. That's what I grew up as we were younger. My grandmother was a great storyteller as well. And oftentimes in the late fall and winter season is when the storytelling would occur. And it was a way of teaching the morals and the values of our people, but also the history and the connection to the land and the animals, the fish, the air, the earth. And so these really demonstrated to us the importance of our relationship and reciprocity with the land, understanding that the animals and fish were relatives, as was the earth, our mother. And so that was part of the teaching. And many of them had values and lessons to be learned. Of course, Coyote, in this story, Spiliai, was a teacher. He was also a trickster. And he was often had great courage and, you know, was fearless and did a lot of things to help the people. But at the same time, he was also sly and tricking people into oftentimes doing something they didn't expect to do.
I'd like to talk with you more about the Coyote character in Native storytelling, but also say a bit for our listeners about why this story was chosen to be included in the film I'm working on with a team here in Oregon, including Kathy Sampson-Cruza. The film is titled Necessity, Rail Rivers and the Thin Green Line, and it includes a series of animated paintings by Asa Wright, an artist and enrolled member of the Klamath tribes, that will accompany your narration in this story. In addition to this being a local fable that grounds the film in regional indigenous storytelling, can you say something about what the monster and some of the other images in the story mean to you?
Yeah, you think about what's happening now. These are really demonstrate that our knowledge, indigenous knowledge, is ancient, thousands and thousands of generations, not just thousands of years, and that these knowledges were passed down from one generation to the next, oftentimes through stories, but also through these teachings. And these stories were brought out in the winter time because that was a time where the people were still and were surviving through the winter. They had gathered their foods all spring, summer, and fall and prepared them. And so this was the time for the teaching, and this is where the elders, not just the parents, but the grandparents, the aunts and uncles, were teachers amongst the people. And these were stories about the morals of our people, indigenous connection to the land. And so this story really talks about this animal, this monster who was greedy and came back up the river and began to eat everything. And the long story has a lot of different aspects about how the animals were made from the body of this monster, and that were eaten. They came out and were thrown to different parts of the land, and that's where they came from. There's a story about as the monster was dying, one of the last ones to come out the anus of the monster was the stink bug. We call him Titi. And that was why he is the way he is, because he came out the opposite end. And so many of these stories are related and talk about the connection of the creation of the land, creation of the animal people. And they go to the beginning of time when the Netitite, our human beings, were coming to this earth, coming to this land, and how the animal people all stood forward and were called upon. The men in particular came forward to be the salmon, the nusach. And the responsibility of salmon was to go to the great body of water, the ocean, and gather food up and bring that body, his body, back so that the Netitite, the human beings, would have food to eat. The nusach, that was his responsibility. And his sacred name is Waikanish. And when we have those ceremonies every year, we honor Waikanish for following the law, what we call Tamanwit, the law that the Creator gave us to live by. And in return, our Netitite, our Indian people, are supposed to take care of those animals, take care of the river, which is the blood of our earth mother, take care of all the things that the Creator bestowed for us, gifted us at the beginning of time. And these are part of our still our ceremonies that we practice, our spiritual and religious beliefs. They are sacred and holy. And so we continue to remind ourselves through song and through these stories, these legends, these prophecies about our obligation and our connection to the land, our relationships. Same way goes on with the roots and the berries and all of the foods that were given Indian names. We honor and respect them today. So that's a little bit of history about our people and the relationship to these stories and our relationship to the earth. And we're seeing things that are happening now that we had heard about in prophecies, and we're seeing these impacts on the land because the non-Indian people have basically abused the land and forgot what their role and responsibility is as equals and having a reciprocal obligation to protect things as those also provide for us as well as the human beings.
So the monster in this story has different dimensions to it, and that we are all taking from and depend on the creatures in the world around us, which is a different relationship to nature than colonial settler culture, which views the natural world as a resource to be tamed, controlled, or extracted from. So in this story, the monster is, in a sense, part of nature itself, but There is a warning that things are out of balance, of an exploitive relationship to nature, and coyote embodies resistance to that, resistance to the monster that takes over, that devours. So the story could be read as a metaphor for colonialism. Would you agree with that kind of interpretation?
Absolutely. And I think it's the human nature that we as human beings oftentimes have the ability to think in a different way. And you'll see this all over the world, but particularly here in America, when the immigrants came here, they began to exploit the land, and their perspective was that they owned things, that they had a right to take things and use them for their own rich and greed and power. And I think that's really what Coyote was always telling us, is that you have to be humble, and this is the way that our people were raised. You have to share. You have to be respectful. You have to know what reciprocity is, which means you take only what you need and you give back. And that's the importance of this way of life that we had. And I think that is really what's happening, is that this story kind of illustrates that things will change. The people, the salmon will be gone. The food will disappear. And we're seeing that happen right today because of the industrialization of our country, our native country here. It was a beautiful, productive country 400, 500 years ago, and it's been exploited much like Europe was in the 1200, 1500s. And now we're seeing the impacts, whether it be dams on the river, polluted waters, we're seeing air pollution, we're seeing climate change, which is increasing these catastrophic wildfires. The fossil fuel industry and industrialization has transformed this earth. And now this earth is much stronger than we think and is more powerful than we could imagine. We're insignificant. And there was a time where we lived in balance. And that's what we're trying to do now, is refine that balance and that respect. And so indigenous knowledge and these stories and the wisdom that we bring from these generations is very useful today, not only just for our indigenous people, but for all people around the world, and that they have to learn to live in balance with the earth, respect things. And I think that's really part of what the story tells, and many other stories. We have prophecies that projected that we'd be seeing these things now, and indeed that's what's happening. And so as indigenous people, we have to be strong. We have to go back to our indigenous values and our lifestyle.
In closing, can you say a little more about how you would weave together the themes of tragic loss and trauma on the one hand as part of Indigenous history that's so important to be told and remembered, as well as the stories of creative resistance and resilience? For many of us on the documentary team, Coyote represented that creative and clever side of fighting an enemy that is in many ways more powerful than you. So how do you think about those two sides of storytelling and a path forward for all of us?
Well, that's, as I mentioned, Coyote was a teacher, and the creator, Namipia, sent him to teach us, and there were times when we were going the wrong way, or we fought within each other or against each other or did something wrong. He came back to teach us the right way of life, how to live. And so today, as Indigenous people, we are banding together across the United States, across countries around the globe, and the knowledge and the experience and the truth that we bring about how we live in harmony with the earth is really what's guiding people now. They're starting to listen finally after all these years. When we were exploited and the genocide that occurred, our lands taken, our culture, our language taken, boarding schools, all of that is now coming full circle, and our people are beginning to strengthen, renewing our language, renewing our connection, renewing our spirituality. We think that will be what leads the world into a better future.
and a path forward for all of us.
Yeah, and I think that's really important. We have a new generation of people, young people coming up. You know, you think of the Greta Thunberg as one example of people saying, look, we can't just think of ourselves and short-term gain over the long-term future of our children like us. And they're speaking up, and they find that connection with Indigenous people because we care about the seven generations that follow. You know, we only borrow this land from our children, and we're obligated and duty-bound to give it to them better than it was. And so that is really our responsibility. So that is something that I think is true amongst many tribes and Indigenous people around the world.
Well, Don Sampson, I hope we can have more conversations about Native storytelling and climate justice. We've been recognizing this story by Esther Motonic, but as you say, there are many stories to tell, and they play in all cultures a vital role and have an important place and in inspiring people during a time that can seem bleak and hopeless, but also as we try to find a way forward through this climate catastrophe we're in.
Yep. We have to be coyote. We have to be creative. We have to think right. Sometimes I get called coyote, but I think you're a coyote too, Janice.
Yes. I'm honored. I'm so honored to be a coyote with you. This is Jan Hawken talking today with Don Sampson, chief of the Walla Walla tribe, about the story, The Monster Who Came Up the River, that will also be included in the film, Necessity, Rail Rivers and the Thin Green Line.
Sisters have died. Over 500 years has washed away our fears and strengthened our pride. Now we turn back the tide. We will no longer hear your commands. We will slide your control from our lands.
Buffy St. Marie singing Sing Our Own Song. This is Robin White, the Old Mole Radio Hour, KBOO, Portland, Oregon. Next up, Bill Resnick interviews Oglala Lakota tribal member Henry Red Cloud.
Hello, Chief Henry Red Cloud. Welcome to Cable here in Portland, Oregon.
It's an honor to be here, Bill.
Chief Henry Red Cloud is a Lakota at Pine Ridge in South Dakota. He founded the Lakota Solar Enterprise business, and also Red Cloud Renewable, an educational nonprofit. Both are part of an overall project that is drive pursuing a mission of preserving and enhancing a traditional culture in a modern world, for which he received an honorary doctorate in public service. We'll be discussing the Lakotas at Pine Ridge and the Solar Enterprise and Red Cloud Renewable, and then switch gears to discuss the big picture of Native American struggle across the country. And indeed, Indigenous and organizations are engaged in the fight for a livable Earth across the planet. So Henry Red Cloud, tell us about the Lakota Solar Enterprise and Red Cloud Renewable, and why you and others worked to establish it.
Yes, okay, Bill. Greetings. A good hearty handshake from my heart. Yes, Red Cloud Renewable and Lakota Solar, RCR, is my nonprofit training institute here. We offered a national certification, working with over 50 of the federally recognized tribes. Overall, Bill, there's 574 federally recognized tribes. So we're just barely scratching the surface, so to speak, creating economic opportunities around solar. As you know, Biden administration is going to be releasing some funding based around clean energy, and quite a bit of it's target towards Indian country. The reason is NREL, National Renewable Energy Laboratory out of Colorado, has done a study and found that through the 574 federally recognized tribes, there's a potential of 61 gigawatts of clean energy that can be produced out of these respected nations. So RCR, we've been in existence since 2008. We opened the doors to the training facility and had over 700 students come through our program now. For the last couple years, for the past 3 years, we have offered the national certification in solar installation, where students can come through our program, then become instructors, business owners, or work anywhere in the country installing solar. So that's the RCR part of it. LSE, Lakota Solar Enterprises, is our for-profit business. LSE got started with the solar hot air furnaces back in 2003. We start manufacturing these systems. Very easy to operate. Saves, 30% of the heating costs for homeowners. What we did was took the 1970s concept of air heating and implemented 21st century material. With that, we was able to create an animal of a hot box, which circulates the air within the home throughout the day during the winter months and saves homeowners, 30% of their heating costs, but creates economic opportunities. Here in Lakota country, as well as across Indian country, there's need of jobs, especially here with the Lakota. So we're bringing forward the technical support, working with tribes, along tribes with them, and creating that economic opportunity and helping them in their membership to save dollars on their heating, or may it be the kilowatt usage, and through that creating economic opportunity. Here, culturally, we have this other program happening, Bill, which is taking our old way of living and creating this new way in the 21st century, reviving the old Teochpa'e system here, which we have a project called Wechoni. Wechoni is bringing like-minded thinking natives to the table and creating this sustainable community. We're looking at building earthen block homes, and this newest thing we're getting into is foamcrete. The R value within foamcrete is a 30 R value. A 30 R value, that's really high. So savings through cooling and heating. So creating this sustainable community, Teochpa'e, and bringing forward food, traditional Lakota foods and medicines, and as well as the other garden produce, bringing that forward and being able to coexist with the land again within this sustainable community, then everybody from young to old will all have a role and something going on here, as we did in our old cultural ways as we moved about the prairie hunting the buffalo.
Are you using traditional materials also for manufacturing this insulation? Is that part of the story?
No. We're not manufacturing insulation. We're using foam and concrete, a mixture, and creating these tiny homes. Then it creates that 30 R value. These units are 250 square foot, really energy efficient, and have 16-inch walls with their 30 R value, and the cost is less than $10,000 per unit for the shell.
In view of the fact that Pine Ridge is really one of the poorest communities in the United States now, and the homes are often not insulated and have just fairly fragile wooden walls and ceilings, I read that many homes have no electricity at all, a fairly large segment of the population. And in fact, the life expectancy also, shockingly, is less than 60 years for people on the reservation. That's really a terrific thing that you're doing and organizing people. Hi, folks. Cable Radio 90.7 FM, Portland, Oregon. This is your old mole variety hour every Monday at 9 a.m. The variety in the old mole is in the variety of struggles from below that we cover. This is Bill Resnick talking to Chief Henry Redcloud of Lakota at Pine Ridge in South Dakota. He founded the Lakota Solar Enterprise, a business, and Redcloud Renewables, an educational nonprofit being used by many other tribes and indeed, I'm sure, some non-tribal people as a training center in renewable energy and many other renewable technologies. Henry, talk about the values that guide your work, Lakota values, and how these technologies fit in with them.
Yes, I would love to, Bill. As you know, the Lakota, they practiced the Sundance. Way back in ancient times, there was a gift given to the Lakota people, and it came in the form of the white buffalo calf woman. She brought this sacred pipe, and she brought ways of song, dance, and connecting with the Great Spirit. Through the sun, through Ampetuit Havonia Wakan, the life-giving force of the sun. And that's our way, that's our culture. Our language, our song, our dance, our way of life is based around the sun, as well as many other nations. With that, we're taking this 21st century way, Bill. We're taking this and honoring the old way and then becoming sustainable and economic opportunities, lessening our carbon moccasin rent, and starting to take this new way and protecting the earth. As well, you know that climate change is upon us. We need to all be doing this. We need to be protecting the earth and doing what we can around clean energy. So how this fits in culturally, using the sun to power your homes, using the sun in every aspect to recognize the old way with this new way, and then creating that wonderful way of living for future generations, for seven generations, I'm looking down the road, and having the prestigious air and water and earth and the soil and to grow things and that. So what we're doing here is creating that, as well as helping people to creating economic opportunities, creating jobs, much needed jobs. So that's how it fits into our cultural ways here.
In traditional cultures, it seems to me that, and especially in the Native American way of life for most tribes, in daily life, people all had important roles, and work was not so routinized and specialized. People had different roles, but they cooperated together, and my sense is that everybody was seen as an essential worker. That is, they were treated with respect, but they were also given respect in daily life, whatever the important role that they did. And that of course, was for thousands and thousands of years these cultures have developed. What about that hypothesis? It seems to me there was a very democratic way of daily living where everybody was seen as an essential worker, given this.
Yes.
And differences in function did not create a huge difference in the comforts that they had and the goods that they assembled in their homes. People lived fairly democratically in an egalitarian life. My sense is that your aims consistent with that.
Yeah, yeah. Everybody had a role in the Tioche Baye system. Everybody. It takes a community to raise a child. And so with that, saying that, everyone within the Tioche Baye had a role in doing their part as making the community, the Tioche Baye, healthy and striving and moving forward. So that's what we're doing, targeted around our Wechoni project, creating that, because we still have that here. We're in the southwest corner of the state of South Dakota. South Dakota overall has about 800,000 inhabitants here with nine tribes. 800,000 people, and there's like 20 to 25% native here in the state of South Dakota. So that's not much people with the land base that we have here in South Dakota. You could look at it as being in a rural area. And so we were able to retain our culture, our language, our song, our dance, our ceremony. We still have that with us, our language especially. We still have that. So creating this a new way of Tioche Baye governance, taking 21st century material ways there and creating this new way where it can be replicated across Indian country as well as non-native areas. We have nine tribes here within the state. We have the Lakota, Nakota, and Dakota tribe.
One final thing, Chief Henry Red Cloud, you've been talking to today about the various projects that is a major part of in Pine Ridge country. We've been talking about his projects. Henry, most climate action people, probably a majority of the aware people of the United States, know of the struggle, the Native American struggle across the United States over pipelines and oil and gas transportation and delivery and refining, trying to stop it with their bodies. Huge numbers of arrests recently. Some of the struggles actually are successful, some haven't been. But much less is known about what you're doing, and most of the tribes are doing, but much less is known about your efforts to build a economically successful community based on Lakota values. Tell us about, for a minute, your involvement, the extent of the involvement with the other Native American tribes.
Okay, Bill. Yeah, we're currently working with over 70 tribes of those federally recognized tribes. So, yeah, so getting out and reaching out to more of the tribes, I found that you can use advertisement, you can use social media, but moccasin telegraph is the best way to get things out. And that's how it is here in Indian country. Moccasin telegraph is the best. It's faster, it's more reliable than texting, email, and all of that. When people start to share within their circles on what a person's, you know, doing. So we look excitedly to the future to work with more of the First Nation communities. You know, they're special. All of these tribes, they have a signed agreement. They have a treaty with the federal government, what makes them unique. They're a nation within a nation. So working with them to create all of this economic opportunities and using the sun to do this is the best way that I think that we need to be going forward.
Chief Henry Red Cloud, thanks a lot for talking to us today. Thanks a lot for your work. We'll do it again.
Okay. All right. Well, stay low. Good. Very good.
Thanks a lot.
Bye. Thank you, Bill.
One family. If we don't stand, who will? On earth. The wind comes in four corners, four directions, four colors.
and death rides on four horsemen. A black snake with some black tank. How much money do these companies need to make? They could drop their product, but they wanna save a buck. Already extracted billions, when is enough enough? I used to be in the oil fields, getting paid. But I quit, cause oil water I can't drink. Look down and see Kamimi La die in the mud. I looked up and told myself that enough's enough. Money does not own my soul, living comfortable. It's not in my plans, my hands in the sand. Some things worth more than gold. Some things they can't be sold. Some things can't be replaced. She is your mother, the fresh water is her veins. What is going on? Have we all lost our minds? Every human needs clean water to survive. I'm Mexicano, Malacota, and I'm white too. I'm mixed with everyone, so part of me's just like you. Every group of human beings shares the same stars. And if the Earth is not your mother, are you from Mars?
You were just listening to Prolific the Rapper and A Tribe Called Red doing Black Snakes. This is Lakota Cheyenne Mole Robin White. I've been your host today for our Indigenous Peoples Day programming on the Old Mole on Portland's KBOO radio. Today's show, produced by Desiree Helgers. Denise Morris produced Bill Resnick's interview with Henry Redcloud, and John Hocken produced her interview with Chief Don Sampson. We're going to play out with No More Pipeline Blues, a resistance anthem out of the Line 3 Resistance, featuring Winona LaDuc, Day Sisters, Moo Moo Fresh, Pura Fay, Sony Moreno, Jennifer Kreisberg, Indigo Girls, Wabenoekwe, Bonnie Raitt, and Joy Harjo.
This is the same water that was here when dinosaurs were here. There is no new water. This is the only water we will ever know. This is the same water that my great ancestors drank from and harvested our wild rice upon.
On this land.